Sternan.
Good morning.
May Let me first thank the Federal Defender's Office for taking this assignment, which is outside their normal line of work, I should say. So thank you to your office for doing this for us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, once it is made clear that Mr. Ibrahim's petition involves a claim of actual innocence based on newly discovered evidence, in addition to several claims of constitutional error, there's actually very little disagreement between the parties in this case. The district court dismissed Mr. Ibrahim's petition for lack of jurisdiction, citing D.C. Code Section 23110, subsection G, which bars those convicted in D.C. Superior Court from seeking federal habeas review for claims that are cognizable under D.C. Code Section 23110. This was clear error. In dismissing Mr. Ibrahim's petition for lack of jurisdiction, the district court failed to appreciate that claims of actual innocence based on newly discovered evidence are in fact not cognizable under D.C. Code Section 23110. This particular issue has been considered and it has been decided by the D.C. Court of Appeals. The government does not dispute this, and nor could it. Because neither Mr. Ibrahim's actual innocence claims nor his attendant constitutional claims are cognizable under D.C. Code Section 23110, 23110G does not act as a jurisdictional bar in this case. Accordingly, Mr. Ibrahim asks that this case be remanded to the district court for consideration of the merits prong of the Certificate of Appealability analysis, which at that point would address, in the first instance, his constitutional claims.
Would address what?
His constitutional claims.
What is it that takes his claim out of 23110A1?
D.C. Court of Appeals decision in Diamond decided that no aspect of 23110 none of this is cognizable under any aspect of 23110. But Your Honor, what was the section A1 that the sentence was imposed in violation of the Constitution? Okay. That's basically the holding of Diamond. Arguably, this would implicate Herrera. There's a question of whether or not an actual innocence claim standing alone based on newly discovered evidence does implicate the Constitution. That's still open. It's not open in the D.C. Court of Appeals, however.
What I think is the critical page of Diamond 2 in front of me, and what the court there does, the court's basis for throwing out the claim, is essentially that the newly discovered evidence claim is so weak that it doesn't meet the standard of Schlupp. Right? That's just what would have happened in the district court if it ever got to the district court, right?
Actually, in Diamond, the Court of Appeals specifically said that the newly discovered evidence claim based on actual innocence would have to have been brought under Rule 33 and that it was not at all cognizable under 23110. So it didn't establish that there was jurisdiction under 23110 to hear that claim. The very clear holding of Diamond was that, and in fact the language in Diamond is that under any circumstance, no matter how compelling the showing of actual innocence, Rule 33 would bar the consideration of an actual innocence claim. Now the converse of that is that if Rule 33 is barring the consideration of an actual innocence claim, there's just no jurisdiction under 23110 for consideration of that claim. And the Innocence Protection Act doesn't change that at all. What the court in Diamond was saying was that a claim of actual innocence based on newly discovered evidence is not cognizable under 23-110. It would have to be brought under Rule 33, and it would be have to be subject to the time limitations.
One or diamond two?
What year, Your Honor?
Focusing on. Yeah. Diamond two is 1999.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. I'm focusing on diamond two. Or, sorry, yes, in the 1999 case.
Okay. So where is it that such a claim is channeled away from 23-110? Let's say, assuming it to be a good federal constitutional claim, because it seems to me the bottom line of Diamond 2 is this claim is not a good federal constitutional claim.
The bottom line of the only aspect, actually, of Diamond 2 that really implicates a discussion of the Constitution is whether or not the Diamond petitioner's attendant constitutional claims were sufficiently related to the claim of actual innocence.
The court talks quite a lot about that, but then the critical sentence, it seemed to me, at page 512, is, in any event, we conclude that the newly discovered evidence with which appellants in this case seek to shift the blame, and they go on to characterize the evidence in quite disparaging terms, does not meet the substantive standard articulated in Schlupp, where the Supreme Court sorts out the confusion that it had created as between a very demanding standard and a less demanding standard for how likely actual evidence might have been.
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. I believe that aspect of the in some sense, that aspect of the opinion is dicta. But also, what should be noted is the fact that this case was after this case was denied in Diamond, this case was brought in this court, not this courthouse, in the district court in Eastridge. And the district court in Eastridge determined that the Schlupp analysis had, in fact, been met. So there's dueling courts here, but the Schlupp analysis had been met in that case as far as the actual innocence hurdle that had to be overcome. I think.
Are you saying that district court decision established federal law for what?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that district court decision recognized that there was jurisdiction to hear a claim of actual innocence based on newly discovered evidence that also had attendant constitutional claims.
Brought before us the reasoning of the district court.
In fact, well, that Your Honor, the reasoning of the district court that was done on the in a transcript. It was done in open court. It was not done via a written opinion.
Right.
So the court.
What was the reasoning that you're asking, in effect, asking us to find convincing?
Well, Your Honor, I think actually we're getting ahead of ourselves here, because the what Diamond is very clear on is that 23-110 is that these claims are not cognizable under 23-110. Now, if somehow, and what I'm hearing you say is that.
Where is it clear on that? Because I guess it seemed to me the bottom line is an assessment of the substantive quality of the petitioner's evidence.
Your Honor, if that is the case, if that's how you're reading the case, the takeaway as far as the application to this case would be, if I'm arguing that the court held that there is actual innocence claims based on newly discovered evidence are not cognizable under 23-110. And in fact, the government admits that. It agrees to that.
Because if that's what it's saying, then this passage, which is sort of the wind-up to the whole opinion, is completely unnecessary and silly.
Well, but the fact of the matter is, if that were the case, if we take it for the sake of argument that the end game of Diamond is a schlep analysis, then we're still out of the realm of 23-110. So that doesn't do anything.
Where is it that you see the Diamond 2 precluding 23-110 for a claim, for a federal claim that satisfies schlep?
A federal claim that satisfies schlep,
I mean, I'm just asking for the language in the opinion that does that.
I would stick to the there's no language in the opinion that I think leaves any opening for an opportunity to bring a claim under 23-110 that's based on newly discovered evidence based on actual innocence. And again, the government admits that. The government, on page 6 of its brief, the government says, I can read it. That is actually not a point of dispute in this case. That's one of the things that we agree on. Page 6 of the government's brief, it says DC Code 23-110G does not bar a federal court from hearing a habeas petition that raises a statutory innocence claim under the IPA, which is essentially what we're saying here.
I mean, at least one reading of that passage is that it's talking about a situation where D.C. law gives broader relief than federal constitutional law, which is fine, obviously. But I thought here we had a claim that this is something that satisfies federal constitution. I do see at the beginning there, you know, they're talking about earlier actual innocence claims and the effect of Rule 33 and so forth. But in the end, they go on to this attempt to see whether this fits within schlup and conclude that it doesn't.
Your Honor, at the end of the opinion, I think one of the most important things that maybe we're overlooking here is the fact that the court very clearly says, one who reads Superior Court Criminal Rule 33 in conjunction with the Supreme Court's decision in Herrera is led to the uncomfortable sense that an innocent defendant may be executed or left to rot in jail because conclusive exculpatory evidence through no fault of his own came to his attention too late. And it says under Rule 33, passage of a relatively short time, 2 years, acts as an absolute bar, no matter how compelling a showing of innocence may be. Now, that doesn't leave an opening to me. There's no standard there.
The opinion should stop, right? Except to the extent that court recognizes that there is a class of claims which are federal claims. And involve some use of actual innocence, as in schlup.
I think the answer is schlup is just a way. So the schlup standard is a way to have procedurally barred claims reviewed. These claims would never come under 23-110, assuming I don't read Diamond to leave any opening for the possibility that 23-110 would be the avenue for to bring an actual innocence claim. That in fact that's why the D.C. Court of Appeal, or sorry, not D.C. Court of Appeals, but the D.C. Council passed the Innocence Protection Act. The last part of the Diamond opinion was a plea by the D.C. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Council or Congress or someone to do something.
Attention to something I actually only noticed now.
Mm-hmm.
The opinion has parts 2 and 3 with big Roman headings.
Mm-hmm.
The part that you rely on is newly discovered evidence in the claim of actual innocence. And then we have Roman 3, the alleged constitutional violation. So it seems to me that it's that section of the opinion that we have to look to when the question is what is a what should happen under 23.110 for federal constitutional claims.
I think what's happening there is Rule 33 was used as a procedural bar to for these constitutional claims. There's a section of
that makes the court's division of the opinion into newly discovered evidence, constitutional claims, crazy.
Well, Your Honor, in that section, that very section that you're speaking of, that section contains the statement that I think requires a remand in this case, which is the following.
Where are you?
You said you were under section 3, and I'm on page
511.
Okay.
And it's under subsection B, the newly discovered evidence of the constitutional issue, and the constitutional issue.
Right.
So that's an entire section as well, and that's where there is a discussion of Schlupp. But that starts out with the assumption. This is where we're talking about the constitutional claims as opposed to the newly discovered evidence claim, which is what you're saying.
There's no jurisdiction in the federal court for a non-constitutional claim.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. And that's where Schlupp comes in. Because, absolutely. And that's why we're not talking, Your Honor, I guess I would have to implicate Herrera before conceding that too much. I do think that there's an argument that Herrera leaves open the possibility that there's a freestanding actual innocence claim, and that does implicate the Constitution.
Okay, to be sure. But
yes.
But then we're in.
But we're not.
110A land.
But we're not, Your Honor. That's what I hope to make clear here. The D.C. Court of Appeals reading of Herrera, and that's in that quote that I read, and I can read again.
Which is that? Exactly?
This is from page 513 into 514 of Diamond, where the court of and I do think that this is a very important quote, because the government says that. And listen, I really do think that we are getting well ahead of ourselves, seeing that the standard that we're dealing with here is whether or not jurisdiction is debatable in this instance, because we're looking at the first prong of the certificate of appealability analysis.
I'm going to ask you a question that probably is unfair and isn't what the case is about. But what is the newly discovered evidence? I found the segment of his filing that described reasons why he says he's innocent, but I did not read in them anything that told me when something new came to his attention that would have proved that to a court.
The newly discovered evidence is what was listed in the what you're citing with it that you saw. You know no more than I do, which
you
is
don't
why.
Know either why.
Yeah. Well, exactly, and that's.
I'm sorry. It sounds like people he would have known about all the time, or.
Including himself, he said, I was wearing a shirt.
Yeah.
That's not newly discovered evidence.
Well, that's another, that's something else that I think that, first of all, it was a pro se pleading. I think
well,
we need to give
that,
it liberal construction.
That means we give it liberal construction.
Right.
But we still construe what's there. And what is it that's there that tells us there's some evidence here that's newly discovered?
Well, I suppose you can't, that there's nothing there that says that it's not.
You into it.
Well, there's, right, but right. It's being proposed to the court as newly discovered evidence. Some of it obviously is not. But without comparing it to the record, without knowing whether or not, without having a government response, we don't know whether it is newly discovered evidence. I can't tell you otherwise.
Tell us something upon which we could base a conclusion that there is some newly discovered evidence that would warrant relief. And granted, we're supposed to liberally construe what he says, but we're not supposed to write some more onto what he said.
No, I understand.
I don't really find anything that sounds like newly discovered evidence.
Well, but it could. There are a few that are obviously not, but there are some that we, if he's saying it's newly discovered and we have no, there's no record evidence, no record in this case at all, there's no way to say that it's not. So I would just say that there's enough there to get over a hurdle. And again, this would be something for the district court.
You can say whatever. It's not clear. What if you characterize as constitutional claims? How would you characterize?
Your Honor, the same as he characterizes them. So a due process, equal protection, Sixth Amendment, miscarriage of justice.
Is there any relationship between his claim that I'm not guilty with his constitutional claims?
That's something that I think needs to be developed
Can you tell on the face of it can you see any relationship?
On the face of it, yeah. I would say I can't. But what's interesting about that is in Diamond, the court made it clear that if there's no relationship, then it's between the constitutional claims and the claim of actual innocence, then they're not, nothing's cognizable under 23.110.
That's just before it's in any event sentence.
Right.
But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes. And
it made it clear, not clear to me.
And it also says that we'll assume for the purposes of this appeal that we're newly discovered
related,
evidence.
They could be brought under 110.
Assuming. Yeah. And because we don't know what their relation is, all we are asking is for a remand to the district court so that the government could answer the petition. And really, we're the standard here at this point, because again, we're conceding that there's not enough to get over the second prong of the merits prong of the certificate appealability analysis. We would like for the court to proceed as it did in Williams v. Martinez and remand for consideration of that prong. So at that point in our procedure, we're really only looking to see whether or not the court had arguable jurisdiction, debatable.
We've taken you well beyond your time, and we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if needed. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent, appellee, whatever you are in this case.
Good morning. May it please the court. Yep. Coleman for the United States. The district court's denial of a certificate of appealability should be affirmed. The petition that was filed below doesn't present either of the two showings that must be made for a certificate of appealability to be issued. It does not clearly show the denial of a federal constitutional right. And it doesn't show that it's debatable whether or not the district court's procedural ruling was correct. Now, first of all, I'd like to respond to something which Amicus raised today, which is whether or not the Diamond Court left open the possibility that a claim of actual innocence could be brought as a constitutional claim under Section 23.110. In fact, Amicus conceded this on page 28 of its opening brief. In footnote 21, Amicus admitted that, quote, the question of whether newly discovered evidence leading to a claim of constitutional error could ever be reviewed under Section 23.110 was left open by the Diamond Court. And that, in fact, is simply a required reading of Diamond, because Diamond left that question open, just as it thought the Supreme Court had left that question open in Herrera. The question is whether or not, if you are saying I've got new evidence of actual innocence and it rises to the level of a due process claim, a violation of due process, whether that could be a freestanding constitutional claim. The Supreme Court still hasn't said whether that claim exists. The Supreme Court said Herrera in that case had not met that showing. Diamond said exactly the same thing. It noted that Herrera had left that claim open, noted that Herrera had been held not to have met that standard, and said that here, too, the appellants in Diamond have not met that standard. Because of that, and because it is not clear whether or not petitioner is raising that kind of an actual innocence constitutional claim, it is certainly by no means clear that he cannot bring this claim under Section 23.110. And because of that, the district court's ruling is entirely appropriate. If that's the claim that he's raising, then he needs to raise it in the Superior Court under Section 23.110. Now, amicus raises two new arguments in the reply brief, the first of which seems to be the idea that perhaps petitioner is raising actual innocence merely as a gateway to unrelated constitutional claims. First of all, we'd say that it's by no means clear that petitioner is in fact doing that. I think as amicus just conceded, it is not at all clear from reading the petition what claims he is actually making, what evidence is newly discovered, and whether there's a relationship between the two. Now, amicus's response to that is to say that, well, it should be the role of the district court essentially to comb through the record, determine what precise claims of constitutional error at trial are being made by petitioner, which parts of his evidence are newly discovered, and whether there's a connection between the two. Of course, if the district court were to do that, even assuming that were its role, it might discover that all of these claims are properly brought under Section 23.110. And then the case has to then go to the Superior Court. We submit that the sensible approach is that if any court is supposed to do that, it's the Superior Court, because the Superior Court would be the one to determine whether or not the claims are cognizable before it under Section 23.110. And under the appellate review of the D.C. Court of Appeals, it could decide whether those claims may be brought.
Is it your sense that under, I mean, maybe it's been made clear by some decision, that if a thing goes through the whole 23.110 system, then the prisoner loses, that he or she can then invoke 110G and have a shot at it in the federal court, saying that for some reason or other the court misunderstood the law or whatever, the Superior Court outcome or process was ineffective?
No, Your Honor. Garris, a decision issued by this court, fairly clearly holds that, as does Swain v. Presley from the Supreme Court. Section 23.110, according to the Supreme Court, was intended by Congress to function just as Section 2255. It is the habeas relief that is available to District of Columbia prisoners.
What is it you make of the sentence that counsel call our attention to quite often, the rot in jail language? What do you make of that?
Well, again, the indictment, at most, that statement is dicta about a situation that the court in Diamond felt was not presented, namely an appellant who is presenting such compelling evidence of actual innocence that had no avenue of relief. Again, the court let.
They say Rule 33 in conjunction with Herrera. So what's that add up to? I mean, if it's within Herrera, then it seems to be fine. Let's say they can hear it under 110A1. The Superior Court can hear it under that. If it's not, then. I mean, this is an arguable interpretation of this line, then because of Rule 33, the person will rot in jail.
Well, I have two responses. I mean, again, the Diamond Court was expressly not presented with the kind of claim, and it also felt it wasn't presented factually with the record that would support such a claim, of saying that actual innocence is so compelling here that it rises to the level of a due process claim, which would somehow then take it out of the strictures of Rule 33.
Right.
The Diamond Court left open.
You're reading it, I take it. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. That there are two levels. There's a claim that meets the criteria of Herrera. That's fine for 110A1. They're claims that are really good, but fall short of Herrera, and those fall under Rule 33, and he's going to rot in jail if it's too late. It's before the IPA.
I think that is the practical effect of the Diamond Court's decision, Your Honor. I mean, they weren't addressing they didn't have before them the putative Herrera claim, which, again, you know, we still don't know whether such a claim actually exists, but if it does, they said it's not presented here. So there certainly has been no express ruling of the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Suppose you have a D.C. Prisoner who's serving a life sentence and for rape and murder, and after 10 years there's a DNA analysis for the first time that shows that it wasn't him. Now, does he bring that, if he wants to bring that claim in Superior Court, under what heading does he bring it?
Well, it is, you know, as a practical matter, the most obvious avenue for him to do that is going to be under DC's IPA, which was enacted, of course, after Diamond. That does not mean, however, that he couldn't say, I'm asserting, I believe there is a claim of actual innocence that rises to the level of a due process violation. I believe that claim does exist. I believe this court should recognize it, and I think that I have evidence to support it. It doesn't mean that he couldn't bring two
such claims. To get into federal court under 2255, he's got to show a constitutional violation, right? Is that right?
Well, you mean a D.C. prisoner?
Yeah.
A D.C. prisoner can never invoke Section 2255, Your Honor. They can exert 23-110, and then if they're going to come into federal court at all, they have to do so through the general habeas statute of 2241.
Through the general habeas. Okay. But in order to get into federal court, forget about the D.C. statute for a moment. What would the allegation have to be at a minimum that he's being held in violation of the Constitution or laws of the United States?
Whether they can get into federal court. Right.
He must show under 23-110G
Suppose we didn't have that statute, okay?
Yes.
The D.C. prisoner convicted in Superior Court then tries to get into federal court on habeas. What is the minimum he would have to allege?
Well, he would have to assert, just as any state court prisoner does from anywhere else in the country, he would have to meet the standards, as currently set by
ETA. Violation of the Constitution or laws of the United States, right?
Correct, yes. He would have to present a constitutional.
But as soon as he makes that allegation, now we plug back in 110. He can't get into federal court because 110 would bar him. He can get into Superior Court, but he can't get into federal court.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that's what Swain v. Presley says.
Yeah.
And it says that is perfectly constitutional for Congress to assign the forum for the habeas right to the Superior Court as opposed to...
The interesting thing here is that this whole business of actual innocence, you may not be aware of it, but it stems from a law review article that Henry Friendly wrote in the University of Chicago Law Review in 1970. And I think the Supreme Court has basically followed what he prescribed, because there are a good many constitutional claims where the prisoner does not have to allege that he's innocent of the offense. Ineffective assistance of counsel comes to mind, for example, and other matters that, you know, they're jury tampering or whatever implicate the fairness of the entire trial. Now, this individual does allege some due process. I can't make cotton or hair of it, but he may well be making allegations that really, that under the Supreme Court cases, he doesn't have to allege that he's actually innocent in order to have a gateway into habeas.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. But again, he still has the habeas remedy. It is Section 23-110.
Right, right.
And that is, you know, again, I mean, that there is no constitutional right to the federal forum per se. That's what Swain v. Presley says, to have your habeas right vindicated. It can be vindicated elsewhere, and Congress has decided it will be vindicated.
Could he have brought an action under the IPA in Superior Court in this case?
Yes, and he did. That's what he said was his prior. In his own petition, he says that was the relief he sought.
I'm involved in the IPA.
Yes, and so so he did seek that. Now, you know, under Williams v. Martinez, an IPA motion is not a Section 23-110 claim in and of itself, so it's not directly cognizable under Section 23-110, but that doesn't mean that his claims cannot be brought under another form in that form. And one of the things I think
And what I'm coming back to is, though, does the freestanding IPA action exist, which is then not cognizable under 110, but could provide, I don't guess, would you have to get the constitutional claim back?
No, it can't, because it's a statutory right, not a constitutional one. Therefore, that's why, although, unlike in Williams v. Martinez, which involved a constitutional claim, namely ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And I think that brings me to a point
prisoner under court orders not to to make further filings?
He's under court orders in almost every court within the District of Columbia, all the way up to the Supreme Court, not to make filings. He was authorized in this instance, except I think for this court, but I'm not aware that this court has restricted his filings. But the District Court, the Superior Court, the D.C. Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court do have restrictions on him. He was permitted to file this petition in this one instance.
So he couldn't file 110.
Well, he can't.
Because he's under a court order not to do it.
Well, I'm not sure the exact parameters of the injunction on him in Section 23-110, and that's not what he's alleging here.
But that can't be a reason to allow the prisoner to come into federal court because he's under an injunction not to file in the superior court. That doesn't make the remedy ineffective.
And I think I think it's also the case that even the possibility that there is a time limit that the D.C. Court of Appeals imported from Rule 33 for innocence claims into Section 23-110 doesn't mean that those claims are not cognizable under Section 23-110 in the same way that the D.C. Court of Appeals has said an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim cannot be brought under Section 23-110. They still can be brought. They just must be brought within a certain time. The kind of claim itself can be brought under Section 23-110A, all of these claims. The fact that he may have a procedural default doesn't mean that, as a matter of law, that a claim never could be brought. Unlike in Williams v. Martinez, the claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, the D.C. Court of Appeals said, could never be brought at any time under Section 23-110 because they did not feel that the Superior Court could have jurisdiction over such a claim.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Suppose we think the district court was right, but the reasonable jurists could disagree about whether the district court was right. What are we supposed to do?
Well, this court can affirm the denial of a COA, even if it disagrees with the underlying reasoning, as long as it feels that the result was correct.
But what do we do with the reasonable jurists can differ?
Well, again, here it's not clear that reasonable jurors can differ because, first of all,
As we see it, it's in this sort of shadow land between the district court getting it right, but reasonable jurists being able to differ with the district court.
I don't think that language is licensed for a petitioner to present a petition that's so vague that we can't discern what the claims are. That can't be what it means that it's debatable. In other words, because otherwise what one would do is just present a petition where it's hard for us to tell what the claims are, whether they might be procedurally defaulted, whether they can be brought under Section 23-110, which is what happened here. That doesn't mean that one now gets a certificate of appealability for this court to try to determine what his claims are. I think it's still, whether it's debatable or not, really has to do with when we know what the claim is and we know what the law relating to it is, whether or not the district court's jurisdictional ruling was debatable or not. But it can't be the case that what that means is that if the underlying petition is so vague that it's hard for us to tell what he's asserting, that therefore the district court must essentially perform almost the work of counsel, trying to go through the record, figure out what his claims might be, whether they could be brought in federal court under Section 23-110G, et cetera.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, we'd submit that
counsel, and we'll give back 2 more minutes for rebuttal to the amicus.
Your Honor, first I'd like to say, in response to the discussion about the IPA being a statutory right and therefore not conferring any sort of jurisdiction here in the court, it doesn't confer jurisdiction, but just because it's a statutory right in Superior Court doesn't mean that let's look at the substance of it. The substance of it is something that could form the basis of jurisdiction
the
here.
The troubling part of that is for it to do so, it has to be a constitutional issue, right?
Well,
if it's constitutional, then it comes under 110A1, doesn't it?
Well, that's the next point that I wanted to get to. There are actually three categories of claims that we're talking about here, and that's why when the government said that we conceded something, we actually didn't. There's three categories, and I think that needs to be clear. One, we're talking about claims of actual innocence that have claims of constitutional law that are completely unrelated. That's one category. Then we have claims of actual innocence that have closely related constitutional issues that come along with them. So let's say that, as I read Diamond, that situation would be the government did something that caused the petitioner to not be able to prove his actual innocence or not be able to discover evidence. Yeah, something like that. So that would be the second category. Then there's the third category, which is the freestanding actual innocence claim that itself could possibly establish a due process violation. So, to be clear,
if it could, then why wouldn't it be under 110A1?
Your Honor, if that's the case, the problem with that is, and that's where we're parsing here, the problem with that is that the D.C. Court of Appeals read Herrera not to keep that question open. The quote that I did point to any number of times said that the only option, the court's reading of Herrera.
That be for litigation in the D.C. Court. If that's wrong, we can't overrule D.C. I mean,
absolutely.
We don't sit as an appellate panel on D.C.
You're absolutely right, but the D.C. Court of Appeals was responsible for interpreting how the 23-110, and so now we have to live with that. And is there a viable option under 23-110?
Somebody has to decide that case is wrong to receive the result, but that doesn't mean it's us.
Right, exactly. But the implications of that case say that there's still an opening here.
We've talked to you for your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank the public defender for their representation on this case. And call the next case.